Hey, Kelsey.
Hey, Brooke.
Want to tell everyone what's happening in this episode?
This episode, we will discuss how the definition of history excludes women, and we're going to learn about two women historians some people forgot, Mercy Otis Warren and Harriet E. Wilson.
Hello, and welcome to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%, the podcast that explores what happened to the women in history class. Now, here's your host, Kelsey Brooke Eckert, and her partner in crime, Brooke Neva Sullivan.
Episode 1, His Story and Her Story. In this episode, the reason we are going to explore for why women are left out of history is the definition of history itself. So, Brooke, I start every class I teach with this question.
Oh, no.
And I'm going to ask it to you. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay.
Teacher, what are they calling? Teacher Kelsey?
Teacher Kelsey?
Teacher Eckert.
All right, Brooke, what is history?
The past. It has to be the past.
The past.
Blanket statement of things that happened in the past.
That is exactly what every student says. And
me and high schoolers, I'm glad we're on the same page.
Yeah, you guys, you are on the same page. And no, and that is what it should be. And on the surface, that's what history is. But what it leaves out is an understanding of A, what the past was, and B, how we measure it. And so the definition of what history is should be a little bit longer. So what is the past? The past is current events. It's mm-hmm. things that happened, that inspired, that enthused people, you know, people were excited about. And our current events are later going to be written about, right? They're going to write about 2020 and the chaos that it was.
How do you even start to swallow 2020 as a historian?
How do you even begin to write that?
And then, January 2nd.
Yeah. Here we go.
It all went to shit.
No, exactly. So how do you begin to take in all the various perspectives and write one narrative of what the past is? You can't. There's not one version of what happened in 2020. There's not one version. People don't agree on a lot of things that are happening right now. They don't agree with how to deal with COVID-19. They don't agree with the Black Lives Matter movement. Hopefully they believe Black Lives in fact matter, because holy moly.
But if you're looking at that scenario, I mean, you can see it from many lenses. As a person and an individual, there's tons of perspective. And then whose you take as truth.
Correct. So the problem with history is just that there are so many different perspectives, and one historian is going to write their version of what happened in that time.
So is this a voted on position that we should be looking for?
No.
You are now our voted historian. Right. Like the giver.
And it's not. It's not a voted position. And in particular, textbooks make us seem like there is this, like, omniscient voice that...
Yeah, like a room of people that get together and collectively agree that this is what we're going to document.
This is how it goes down. And that's just not accurate. And so how it's done is historians take a look at primary and secondary sources of the period, and they sort of weed through all of that information to come up with their best guess as to, you know, the most obvious or best answer to what happened in that time.
That seems like an impossible task.
It's very hard.
Well, and also, it's very scientific almost, too, of like saying, okay, this is what we're going to take. How do you even decipher truth versus narrative versus first person account, second person account, reporters?
Well, and like, who is more authoritative on a topic? So who, you know, I'm living in 2020, so am I the primary source that people should listen to?
Vote for that, but yeah.
Right? But should we listen to Donald Trump's perspective on 2020? Hmm. Or should we listen to, the opposition's perspective or Dr. Fauci's perspective on this year? There's a lot of different angles to consider when we're thinking about 2020. And so history was just as complicated. And you know, when people start freaking out about how bad current events are, I always think about, you know, different events in history where things were worse. You know, I'm like, okay, well, it's not the Holocaust, or it's not, you know, right before the Civil War, there were a politician beat another politician on the floor of the Senate with a cane. You know, like, okay, we're not assaulting each other in Congress yet, so I think we're okay.
That's a bad measurement. But maybe it's like, okay, things happened in the past, but also we have so much media coverage of today's events.
Absolutely.
And ability to intake and decipher today's events from multiple sources that you almost, like, I don't know, if you asked me even about, like, 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a period of time that I was alive, but I was more of a, or less a child. But my perspective of that event was from multiple media sources, but primarily television at that point. Mm-hmm. Whereas if that had happened today, how much we have on social channels and on other networks and things, there's just a lot more coverage that I think is available.
Right. And I think that's shifting how people think about history, because they want more voices from the past that have previously been, you know, not as forthcoming in the historical record, in the story. But I think what we need to be cautious of is when we say history is just what happened, it's the fact. Whose fact are we talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
That should give us pause. And so I want people to be thinking about, you know, if there could be as many histories as there are human witnesses.
Oh, gross. That's a lot.
Right? That's a lot. And so, and that makes the job of a historian really, really challenging.
Yeah. And super overwhelming.
Super overwhelming.
I just like, that's okay. I'm here for this. How many people are we talking about?
So I think that good history is derived consensus on the past. And there's sort of this idea that I like to think about. If you, and this is an old philosopher sort of had this idea, but you know, at different raffles, they'll say, like, if you can guess how many marbles are in this jar.
I hate those things. I'm like, 4 million. What do I get?
I don't know. Yeah, like,
what's four, the highest number?
Right. So you're supposed to guess, and then they, you know, if you are the closest, you win. And one thing that they found is that if all, you know, if we had a room of, you know, 100, 1,000 people all guess, and then we took our guesses and we averaged our guesses, that average is almost always accurate to what's in the jar. The average of the human guess. So I like to think of history in that sense, that, like, if there are, you know, millions and billions of human witnesses to history, the average of what we all perceive is probably the closest to what really happened. And then, of course, you know, that's hard. That's not exactly right, because, of course, there are people that were primary witnesses, and their perspective should weigh more than other people's perspectives. Right. But I think that that's getting us closer to the idea of what history really is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because historians should not really be primary sources to the history that they're writing, right? Like, you and I shouldn't be the ones writing the history of 2020. We lived it. And it's the job of people to compile all the perspectives from 2020 and weed through and determine what really happened. So, therefore, history is the written record. And history being a collection of the written record is problematic, because it leaves out the illiterate, who, in most of history, were women. It leaves out the poor, oftentimes, who don't have access to the ways to write, which is almost always majority women. It leaves out women who are barred from being allowed to write, even if they are literate.
Oh, yeah. And then, you know, to be the good wife was to be docile and quiet and not, you know, forthcoming with information.
Domestic.
So, yeah, absolutely.
So the written history being sort of the collection of the written records that people have put down will systematically leave women out, just because women are writing and recording less in the past.
Yeah.
The other part of the problem there is that women are barred from certain subjects that have dominated the historical records. When we think of history, we think of politics, we think of the military, we think of diplomacy, mm-hmm. and obviously those three things are important, but it excludes, and when we learn about, like, the history of music, the person who teaches you that is not your history teacher, it's your music teacher.
Right.
When you learn about the history of medicine, you learn that when you go to medical school. When you learn about, you know, the history of any subject, you're learning it not from your history teacher. But yet that should tell us that there are all these other histories that don't get included in a history class.
Right.
And that includes the history of domestic life. And I would argue that the history of medicine should be a part of women's history. Yeah, absolutely. And so because history has really focused and narrowed its lens on politics, economics, and economics, military, diplomacy, these different fields that women were barred from being involved in, it's fundamentally leaving women out of the definition of what we're talking about. And so when we say we're studying the past, we're saying we are studying economics, politics, diplomacy.
Yeah, basically we're studying men lives in that time period. And
elite men's lives.
Yeah, absolutely. People that were defining a country versus, you know, yeah. You're basically essentially leaving out the people that helped to build families and the community and the lives around those men. So you're leaving out almost, if not, we say 50%, but it could be more.
It's way more than that. Yeah, I mean, think about all the minority male voices that are lost.
Oh my gosh.
Or the immigrant voices that are lost. So I think of history as literally his story. And that is the one that we all learned. We learned the story of men. I think of it as, and I want to just articulate that if we're talking about something that happened before historical record, they don't even include that in the field of history, right? It's a different field. It's archaeology. so it's a different subject.
Well, and I feel like any time that they bring up a study of people in that community, it's sociology.
Sociology.
It doesn't live in history.
Right, because it's not politics. It's not military.
Exactly.
So I like to think that just because people were sexist then in how they defined what would be written, what would be included, doesn't mean that historians today have to define history that way, because history was, I think, fundamentally sexist. It was saying we think that these are the things that all school children should memorize and know.
Yeah, this is the curricula.
This is the curricula.
Stick here. This is where we're going to go. These are the things that are critical for a student to know and learn and be able to decipher and spit back to us.
Right. So it was sexist then, and we don't have to do that now. We don't have to just I know. It's
louder
so
for the people in the back.
We don't have to do it again. the first professional historians were Greek and Roman, and this is important because a lot of Western culture that is great, but also pretty fundamentally sexist, comes out of Greek and Roman culture. And in a lot of ways, you know, the Renaissance and the Enlightenment encouraged us to follow that, mm-hmm. that culture and bring it back. And Mary Beard is a classicist historian. She is an expert on Greece and Rome. And she talks about how female, in her book, Women in Power, which is a manifesto that she wrote. It's not a history, really. It's awesome. Super short, good read. She talks about how in the ancient traditions that we've all grown up with, female subordination is an important part of being a man. So if you can't control your woman or keep her quiet, then you are not being manly.
So you're failing. You're not part of a quality society at that point in time.
Yes, exactly. And so the Odyssey, Homer's The Odyssey, which was a really important text that came out of the ancient era, Penelope is one of the main characters. And she uses Penelope as an example. In the story, I'm going to quote here, she says, "As Homer has it, an integral part of growing up as a man is learning to control the public utterances and to silence the female of the species." She talks about how the entire work is dedicated to both the absurdity and the inferiority of female power. And so if that's in the text that mm-hmm. sort of dominates this time period, you can sort of imagine how that impacted both the culture and the early historians that are coming out of that period, right?
Right.
If we're really good, strong men writing our history, then we're not including the women in the history. And so it'll be fundamentally a part of our definition.
Gross.
Yeah, exactly. And I think some people might dismiss that as, okay, well, sure, ancient Rome was sexist. Absolutely. All right, here's the problem. In 2013, Time magazine came up with a list of their top 100 people in all of world history. And, you know, 100 people in all of world history. Of course, it's being defined as political, military, blah, 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 all the things we've previously determined.
That fits in the history box.
Right. This is what we mean when we say history. Two of them were women out of 100.
What?
Queen Elizabeth and Queen Victoria. Both of them are white and British.
I mean, bad. Like, these are great women. Like, bad to the bone women of political power and, like, should dominate stories. However, they were not the only women that defined history.
Absolutely.
Like, really?
Really. It's pretty embarrassing.
Feel bad for Time. Usually they have, like, their stuff together.
Usually they do. And unfortunately, it's you know, their definition was people of significance. And that's just, like,
ugh.
It just, like, breaks my heart because it's, like, what, like, where?
What's the definition of significance?
Yeah, let's define that.
Like, who's in the room at that meeting and was like, oh, okay, we're going to go with Queen Elizabeth and Victoria. I think we're good. Everyone else?
And it's also an impossible list to make because
it's incredibly impossible.
Right, 100 people in all of time.
Ultimately, like, there has to be more than that. Like, that just doesn't make any sense.
A piece of the problem is that so many of women's contributions to society are sort of like the daily grind of keeping everybody around them rolling. And, like, I'm sorry, that is significant and fundamental. And I don't know how that should at least have garnered a spot. Like, housewives. Boom.
Please make space for the housewife.
Yeah.
She's the 100 significant person.
I know. And, I mean, women arguably invented agriculture. Like,
oh my gosh,
come on. Like, that woman doesn't have a name because it's probably, like, women, you know, collectively.
Yeah, multiple.
But, geez Louise. So I think the problem that we face today is that we think this field is, like, fundamentally male in what it includes and who it interests. And that's problematic because the cycle sort of continues. There's been a lot of progress over the last few decades as, you know, like, post-feminist movement and, you know, things are shifting to be more equal. Women are, you know, in more jobs outside the home and whatnot. But even today, 60% of high school social studies teachers are men. Over 60% of college history professors are male. And that's down from 88% in the 1960s. So
we're making some progress.
We're making some progress, but women really aren't in this field. And a lot of times when women get doctoral degrees, and by the way, all across the board in universities, women are such a small percentage of the PhDs that are out there.
I imagine.
It's so embarrassing. But the women that do have them often get, like, siphoned off into these other fields. And so they are, you know, in sociology or psychology or women's studies. And
some would say more intellectual than just history, but yeah, there's no one in the history area that's sticking with it. I think it's the same for STEM. I mean, when you look at any of the sciences and the maths, there's not a lot of women in those fields or industries, which is, you know, a big push for today's society and trying to get them attracted into those things. But it also has a level of interest in intellectuality where you want to see representation there. You want to see another woman standing where you want to stand sometimes, and it's hard to imagine that without seeing it first.
Yeah. And not to get too much into this, but I know that in my job from students and community members, there's been a lot of pushback against me as a teacher. I'm the first female social studies teacher that I have ever had, and you know, all my social studies teachers are male, and so and
I could just see like small girls like just coming to life in your class, like finally
here's one, or here's just one. Like, who's this crazy lady? You know, like I think the problem is that our culture suggests that this isn't the place for a female history teacher. I think that's really hard and really problematic. So even when people do get into those jobs, there's a lot of pushback to it. And we can get into my experiences and the experiences of lots of other people with sexism a bit later. But
what are you saying? It still exists in 2020, Kel?
What's important here is that what we think of when we think of history is male-defined and male-dominated, both in the history itself and who's teaching it currently. And so this is really problematic. If teachers want to know more about women, I would say the best thing that you could do is keep listening to this podcast, but also look for other women who are talking about history, because we are inclined to want to include people that are like us in the past. Mm-hmm. And so we tend to cling to those female voices and bring them into our curriculum more. But there are amazing female historians out there that have been writing women's history for decades, and find them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's definitely, you know, from the teachers that I've encountered in my lifetime, they want to include more women's narrative. It's how. And I think that's where this podcast and some of the work that you're doing and other people, where you can find where it weaves in seamlessly to the current system and the current what we need to know for SATs and for testing and all that kind of stuff. It's, you know, it's available to you, and this is how you get it in there.
Absolutely. All right, we're going to take a short break, and we will be right back.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Simply Sunflowers. Simply Sunflowers is a female-owned and operated jewelry, accessory, and gift boutique located on Main Street in Plymouth, New Hampshire. It's the perfect place to purchase a gift to celebrate yourself or one of the remarkable women in your life. Check out Simply Sunflowers online at www.simplysunflowersnh.com or follow them on Instagram. Simply Sunflowers NH.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Explore Plymouth, New Hampshire. Looking for things to do in the greater Plymouth area? Explore Plymouth NH. It is your one-stop guide for all things to do, places to eat, and where to stay. It even has an hour-by-hour event calendar that lets you know what's happening in the area. From live music to workout classes to special events, hop on the site and then go to Explore Plymouth NH. Visit exploreplymouthnh.com or follow along on Instagram, Explore Plymouth NH.
If you think what we're doing is awesome, consider making a donation to fund our work on our website, www.remedialherstory.com. If you are a teacher and have an idea or lesson that features or is about a woman, and you think it fits in a typical curriculum, or you have something that should be included in class because, hello, women are half of humanity, contact us through our website, www.remedialherstory.com. If you would like to contribute as a guest lecturer, be sure to say that. If you would like to come to a live recording, also contact us through our website, www.remedialherstory.com, and tell us what you hope to gain from the experience. You can also follow us on Instagram at Remedial Herstory or on Twitter at Remed Herstory. All right, welcome back, everybody. Women wrote history, and they also published novels, and these should both be integrated into topics that we teach in school. So today we're going to talk and acknowledge two women who can speak with authority on war and life in early America. So the first person I want to introduce everybody to, and this might not be introduction to some people because she probably should be better known, but I don't think she is. And her name is Mercy Otis Warren. Did you know her?
I have no idea, obviously. This is always the re-education of Brooke over here.
So Mercy Otis Warren should be a staple in any history class. Right there with, like, Thomas Paine.
Okay.
Who wrote Common Sense.
What time period does she fit into?
Same as Thomas Paine. So she's the American Revolution era. her husband, Mr. Warren. I always do that because, you know,
we
always,
women get that all the time.
Yeah. So Mr. Warren was a general in the American Revolution.
In the back, Mr. Warren.
but in the build-up to the American Revolution, Mercy Otis Warren was a writer, and she wrote under a pen name, like many women of her era and before did, just to sort of, because it was inappropriate for women to write. And also, I think it was like, how do I get published and recognition? People aren't going to pick it up if it's written by Mercy. They're going to pick it up if it's written by John, you know?
And do we know anything about her husband as far as, like, was he accepting of her as a writer?
Oh, yeah. Very encouraging. And, in fact, we'll talk about other men of her era who encouraged her, like, you know, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington.
Oh, just a name.
Just a couple of people who might have liked her.
I don't know anything about them either, so.
Okay. So she wrote under the pen name The Columbian Patriot, which is a little aggravating because it makes it hard to find things on her when you're, you know, doing a quick Google search. Because sometimes primary sources are attributed to The Columbian Patriot and not to her, which that is her. That's the same person. So that's annoying.
And that's been discovered. It's well known. Columbian Patriot is Mercy.
Mercy Otis Warren. So she...
Get it together, Google.
Yeah, come on. So she wrote a lot of plays. She wrote a play about the Boston Tea Party, for example, and these were performed all around Boston and kind of riled people up about, you know, the war, independence.
Live theater in the streets. So you just
she was willing to say independence before a lot of people were in that time, so really... She was much more, like, anti-Britain.
I mean, that's an incredibly risky word prior to anyone really saying it. Like, stepping away from the crown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She was bold. She was a bold lady. So, challenged by her pen name, challenging to find her, she wrote the first history of the American Revolution before all the men, not the first women's history. She wrote the first history, and it was called The History of the Rise and Rise, Progress, and Termination of the American Revolution. It was published in 1805.
Wow.
And so that's a really important piece.
Wait, was it published under that pen name?
Oh, I don't know. I think it was.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I think it was. So during the war, she followed her husband, like a lot of wives did, providing, like, food and nursing and all sorts of things to the soldiers.
You mean every service that allowed a soldier to go onto a battlefield?
Correct. She did all of that.
Okay.
She knew and corresponded with a lot of the founding fathers. Like, she knew them personally and wrote them letters. She, because she's from Massachusetts, the Warrens and the Adams were really close family friends.
Oh.
And so she and Abigail exchanged a whole bunch of letters on things. And
so she's, like, considered, would that be middle class at that time?
She would definitely be, like, an upper middle class, if not upper class.
Yeah,
of like this
upper echelon white. Okay.
A white, yeah. And I, unfortunately, that's going to be one of the problems, is that a lot of early histories that are written by women are almost always upper class women, which usually means that they're white. And so we'll talk about that with our second lady, because she's not really a historian, even though I classified her as such. But
you do you. It's your podcast.
I lied. So she knew Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, Sam Adams, and all of these people supported her work. And she wrote this history.
So she's going to parties with these dudes, and she's like clinking glasses with the founding fathers and writing about them.
So she was very staunchly anti-federalist, which basically means anti-monarchy.
Okay.
And she was really worried, like a lot of the federalists and the anti-federalists are really the early political parties in the United States.
Right, there's not Republican or Democrat at this time.
No, that's not going to be for many decades.
I actually knew that.
Good job. Crushing it.
You know, I watched Hamilton.
Oh, nice. So she is an anti-federalist and is really worried at the direction that John Adams' presidency takes and some of the positions that he takes.
Weren't we all?
Because he becomes very federalist and sounds like a monarch, and he gets accused of that. And his friendship with Thomas Jefferson kind of declines. Jefferson is, you know, they were very close. I shouldn't say kind of, it declines. It goes, it's bad.
They ain't friends anymore.
Yeah, and so I don't want to get into the men too much because they've been overdone. But but this is a part of the early politics. And okay. Mercy is absolutely an anti-federalist.
She's in the mix. She's like right there.
Yep. So she writes her history, and of course, she's critical of her friend, John Adams. And
rightfully so.
Of course, Jefferson thinks this is great. And so Jefferson...
So he's like, come on down to Monticello, hang out with me, girl. Let's talk about this.
He buys copies of her book and distributes it to all the cabinet members.
Love that.
Because he's obsessed. And so Adams is...
That's like the old-timey of reposting.
Yeah. I'm buying your book.
I'm going to republish it, and I'm going to share with all my buddies.
Yeah.
Repost.
So John Adams, though, is not thrilled. And he's also sort of famous for not being able to take feedback very well. And
white male and upper class from taking feedback? Well, it's so weird.
It's shocking, I know.
I'm blown away.
So he writes her a letter where he basically is like, I can't believe you wrote this stuff about me. And he's really upset. This is what she wrote in the book. She said, his passions and prejudices were sometimes too strong for his sagacity and judgment.
Ooh, nice vocab word.
Woo, I know. So this results in a huge exchange of letters between her and him.
I love, like, imagining angry quill writing. Like,
oh, yeah.
Let me just... They dot it with their tongue and, like, dip it in the ink. I'm so furiously mad at you. And then they, like...
The feathers.
Yeah, it's, like, very aggressive. And they're, like, sweating. It's in a dark room with one candle.
Yeah.
And then they, like, stamp it with... What's that old-timey, like...
Yeah,
the wax.
Yeah.
And then they give it to, like, 16 different maids to get it out the house. Yeah. And, like, make sure this makes it with haste. And it's, like, 16 days later.
It arrives. Shows up on my phone.
Still angry.
The patience that somebody... You must have had to be able to let things go at some, like... But much earlier.
And then another letter comes back a month later and, like, still furious.
A month later. Yeah.
It must be, like, 6 years of anger going back and forth with quill writing.
So,
anyway, sorry.
Warren says that his letters are so marked with passion and absurdity and inconsistency as to appear more like the ravings of a maniac than the cool critique of genius and science. So she makes him seem like his responses are absolutely crazy.
Yeah, and like childish and lame.
Yeah. So Adams doesn't get anywhere in writing his letters to her. And so years later, he remarked to a friend, and this is probably the quintessential male perspective on a female writer, thinker, and historian.
Oh, yeah.
He says, history is not the province of the ladies.
Yeah. Sorry. Get out of here, Adams.
Yeah. So.
You and your glasses. Out.
Smell you later.
Take your feverish quill and go back to your dark hole.
So. Her history was, again, just one of the many pieces that she wrote, right? She wrote plays and pamphlets and other things. When the Constitution was circling around to be ratified, she wrote a anti-federalist critique of it.
Oh.
And I, in a couple years ago, 2017, I was invited by the History Channel and National History Day to... contribute a lesson plan to...
Well, excuse me.
I know. To a pamphlet that they were producing on her story.
Oh, cool.
And
okay.
So a bunch of history teachers from around the country were selected to do this.
Male or female?
Mostly female, although okay. I think there are a couple guys in there. And we all created lesson plans, and I was assigned Mercy Otis Warren. So I bring this up not to name drop things, although obviously I'm doing it.
I mean, the History Channel is pretty bad.
So we're doing that. But the lesson plan is really great because it's an easy way, I think, to put a woman's perspective into your history lesson without even really meaning to do it. All of us teach about the Constitution in history or in government.
Right. Yeah.
And so when we're having students read the articles and understand what all this stuff that's in
there
means.
Yeah, even like her coverage of the Federalists, like... Of the Constitution and Federalist Papers, like that would be amazing for her to.
Yeah, I mean, we all teach the Federalist Papers, so
yeah.
let's read from an anti-Federalist and read their critique of what this document is, and maybe some of the things that she warned about still stand true. So the lesson plan is available on our website, Remedial Herstory, but it's also available through the History Channel and through National History Day. If you look for their Herstory, it's a PDF that's available online, and I posted the full PDF. PDF that includes all the other women lesson plans produced by other people.
Very cool.
So that's up there for people to look at.
Get it.
So, although people like Warren wrote stuff, a lot of times they get lost in the historical record. And I never heard about Mercy Otis Warren, and instead I heard about Thomas Paine, who, I mean, I probably should have heard of Thomas Paine, but I also should know Mercy Otis Warren.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's unfortunate that, like, she got buried, because it sounds like she's just as equally important as Thomas Paine. I mean, we put his pertinence up because that's what we've been told to do.
Yeah.
Versus, like, why not her?
Right. Absolutely.
Very questioning.
So I want to introduce another woman writer, and she's significant mostly because of her personal experience not being in the upper echelon of society.
Good.
This person was a indentured servant, and she...
Wait, so let's explain what's indentured versus...
Indentured servants are people whose servitude have a time cap. So when they, you know,
So they're working something off.
They're working a debt off.
Okay.
Yes.
Versus, like, someone who's enslaved.
They just are enslaved.
Forever and ever, and there's no end date.
Correct.
Gotcha.
So she was an indentured servant here in New Hampshire. Woohoo!
Lucky girl.
Lucky girl. I know. It's awful. But she was also biracial, so she had a...
Wait, what time period is this?
This is... So she's also an early... she wrote her novel. So she goes down in history. Her name is Harriet E. Wilson, and she's important, significant in history in the male definition of whatever that is, because she was the first black woman to write a novel and have it published.
Whoa.
So her novel is published in 1859, but it's a sort of looking back on her life. So her life was
her
like
life
early,
as an indentured slave.
Yeah, in the early indentured servant in the early 1800s.
Okay.
Yeah. So Harriet E. Wilson, so published in 1859, and actually the whole book, which is called My Nig, I'm assuming that's like a derogatory whatever, but the whole book is available online, the PDF. There's a organization that is trying to make story known down in Milford, New Hampshire. So
good for Milford.
I say down because we're up here in the north country.
I don't know why you gave us a southern accent, but I'm here for it.
Okay, sure. I thought it was like backwoods New Hampshire.
But oh, okay. I'm with you.
All right. Fine.
But like Milford's kind of backwoods too.
I think so.
I'm not exactly sure where not backwoods New Hampshire is, but when you find out, let me know.
I will let you know. So her book was thought... So the reason her book didn't make it out is partly a funding issue. So she self-publishes her book. She
self-publishes her book?
Yeah.
I mean...
Because... So she's trying to raise money. This is all... A lot of the stuff is in her preface. She's trying to raise money for herself and her child. And so she writes down her story, and her whole preface is really sad. She's basically like, please, black brethren, like, support my work. Like, oh, I'm desperate here.
Like, seriously? Yeah. Ugh. That must be impossible.
It's really sad. And unfortunately, I think only about 100 copies of her book sold in her lifetime. So it's a little sad, but it's such a... Her book is really great. I've read the first few chapters of it, and it's a really great window into this terribly sad life, because she was indentured in her childhood. So she had been free and whatever in her childhood. Her black father died, and her white mother sold her into indentured servitude.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah,
that's
great.
Awesome.
So it's also an interesting commentary on race relations, on like who your parents are and what race meant to a white mother with a virus.
So
child.
You're putting your history hat on. Where are you kind of trying to build this into their curriculum?
So I could see her story and her book being put into any lesson on indentured servitude, because it's a first person. So
it's a first person account, biracial, female writer.
Yeah.
People
think of it as like an autobiography. So,
and she's a New Englander.
And she's a New Englander.
Is very rare, I feel like, for
yeah.
a story
And I think
like
it's
this.
A really great story, because my sort of... My assumption has always been that indentured servants were mostly white, and that is a fundamentally wrong assumption. And so I think this is a really great I think people sort of say, okay, well, enslaved people were mostly black and African, yeah. and so the indentured servants were probably mostly white then, and that's true. There were white indentured servants coming sure. over from Europe, but here's, you know, a biracial kid who is sold into indentured servitude.
And, like, just a very different perspective to show. And a first-person account, like... I mean, how many of those can we actually find for this type of character?
I know. So, there are lots of little snippets that anybody could pull from her book that would be really
powerful. Great
and powerful in understanding what it was like to be an indentured servant. And I'll just read one little bit. She said, "See her as she walks with downcast eyes and heavy heart. It was not always thus. She had a loving... Early deprived of parental guardianship, far removed from relatives, she was left to guide her tiny boat over life's surges, alone and inexperienced. As she merged into womanhood, unprotected, uncherished, uncared for, there fell on her ear the music of love, awakening, and an intensity of emotion long dormant." There's just so much emotion and power in this couple sentences that...
It's super impactful. I can see that in, like, a literary classroom and historical... You know, you can put that in so many different contexts where someone could just pick it apart mm-hmm. and really dissect what she means here, where you think she's coming from, what could that narrative be. But, meh, I just want to give her a hug.
I know. The whole time I was reading the book, I just wanted to hug her. So her novel's available online. One of the really sad things about why her story didn't come out is, one, she's self-publishing.
Right.
Two... Many people thought she was white.
Oh, really? Which so is really, she can, what's it called, pass? Like, as a white person
maybe
at
she
time.
Could pass as white or something like that, but it led to her not getting credit for being the first woman of color to write a book.
Okay.
And so she's actually several years before the next woman of color to publish. She's really interesting, too, because in her book, in her preface, she talks a lot about not... You know, knowing that there's some, like, that slavery in the South is incredibly terrible and not wanting to seem like she's complaining for her status being
almost, like, apologetic for her circumstances. It's like, yeah. You're allowed to feel bad about your indentured servitude.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think she's a really incredible voice to indentured servitude that any early history of the United States could bring that story in. And share that perspective. But I think more importantly to understanding history versus her story, right? Here's a woman of color trying to write. You know, Mercy Otis Warren had the ear of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington.
Big names.
Yeah. Here's Harriet E. Wilson being like, yeah, also I had an experience during this time.
Yeah.
You know,
and like good for her for even thinking that like her voice should be heard and published.
Yeah.
Like, and those are both such powerful women that could tell such great narratives about their time. But also, I mean, Mercy's character is just someone that's in the fold. And then you have, like, the dichotomy there, too, of
Harriet
yeah. that really could say this was a small moment, but still very powerful.
Yeah, small in, like, a national sense.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, the changing of times.
Yeah. So... These two women are really amazing. There's a lesson plan related to Mercy Otis Warren, and I'm also going to put the PDF for my NIG, Harriet E. Wilson's book, up on our website. It'll be linked there for everyone to access. Next time, we're going to be talking about heroification, which is something that is really problematic in all history instruction, but it also fundamentally leaves women out of history. So I hope everyone will join us next time.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Kelsey. I learned a lot.
Oh, thank you, Brooke.
Thanks so much for listening to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to your podcasts to bring more voices to the conversation. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.
So this happens every once in a while. We made a little factual error in this episode. The Time magazine article that came out in 2013 actually recognized 3 women, not 2. So... 3% of their list was female.
They included Joan of Arc. The point remains the same. The women that made the list in 2013 were women that crossed over into the male sphere. They were all European, they were all white, and they don't really represent the breadth and scope of women in world history.